coming up next on The Health Hustle.
And then when I was 30, I, you know, decided to get off these drugs, and I went through antidepressant withdrawal, which is terrible, but I ended up, I was in Vancouver, Canada, completely randomly, and I was starting to heal. And I was starting to come out of it and starting to realize that I had made a lifetime of decisions through the lens of depression and antidepressants, and that I was in a default of basically saying no. So I said, okay, how do we reverse this? I said, I'm going to say yes to literally every single yes or no question I get. And my plan was to do it for a year, and I started tracking it. And it was as basic as if the coffee barista said, do you want cream and sugar in your coffee? I would say yes, even though I don't take cream and sugar in my coffee. It was like I forced myself to pay attention to every yes or no question and just see what happened. And I did it for 50 days, and two major things came from this experiment in 50 days. The first was that I met someone who would become a long-term partner. We're not together anymore, but it was a five-year-long relationship. And the only reason why we met is because a friend of mine asked if I wanted to go to a sushi restaurant that was horribly inconvenient for me. And I said yes. And I sat down at that table very cranky about a great many things that day, and he sat down right next to me at the supper table, and by the end of the night we were chatting. So that was one. And then the other thing was actually my book, because I had no plans to write this book. I was lost and confused, but I had published a cookbook with my former business partner as part of our bakery. So I'd been through the publishing process in New York once before, and the literary agent at that time, I was chatting with her, and she was basically saying, I don't know what to do with my life or anything. And she goes, well, do you want to write a book about this experience? And I was like, oh, crap.
Yes, I do.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I do. And all right. And that's when I stopped the experiment, because I was like, I got to write a book now. And 5 years later, it came out.
What up, y'all? Corey here. In this episode, I had a chance to sit down with Brooke Seam, who is a private chef for professional athletes. Brooke is also the author of a book called May Cause Side Effects, and she is a Food Network Chopped champion. Crazy. Not to mention, she also has a newsletter called Happiness is a Skill, and she is a creator of The Fuck It Bucket, which is something we get into in this episode, which is essentially where she said yes to everything for far too long. Some of the things that we get into in this episode specifically, though, are Egypt and aliens, that was fun, growing up with a sniper rifle in Reno specifically, the family business of collections, it's sort of what you expect, losing her inner compass, that was fun to find out about, the yes experiment, which we just mentioned, which is the fuck it bucket, moving from intellectual to physical in how she makes decision, scratching your creative itch, the first entrepreneurship experience she ever had, peak cupcake season since she was a baker, early business mistakes, what it's like living in New York City, since I've never actually lived there, dealing with depression, how she actually became a chef for high-performing athletes, rent a cow, I'll leave a cliffhanger on that one, sourdough lessons, a rapid-fire round, and so much more. One last thing, if you're a health or fitness professional and you're having difficulties getting leads, one of the most common reasons that I see this is not having a well-defined niche. If you go to the link in the description, I have a free 3-step process that walks you through exactly how to get clarity on which niche is best suited for you and your business. Without further ado, let's go! Have you ever had a poppy? Are you familiar with these?
I've not.
Really?
Are they a sponsor?
I wish. And you know, they're actually here in Austin. I should actually see if they would, to be honest.
I don't drink a lot of soda.
It's a prebiotic soda, Brooke.
Well, that's all well and good, unless your body doesn't want prebiotics, and then you spend the whole afternoon pooping your brains out. There's your promo.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say. If you want to poop your pants, have a poppy.
Have a poppy. If you need to poop your pants, have a poppy.
That is a problem for some people.
It is, yeah. It
really you ready?
Depends on your issue. Mm-hmm. Am I good distance?
You're good. Okay. Can you hear yourself okay?
I can hear myself.
Brooke Seam, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Thank you. Hi. Nice to be here.
Welcome back from Egypt?
I was, yes. I was just in Egypt.
How was that?
Old.
The country or your experience?
The country. It was. Things are very old there. It was great. I went and I did a little bit of food stuff since I've got that aspect of my life. And then I also went just to look at very old things. And it kind of blows your mind, not only how old these things are, but the scale of the temples and the pyramids and everything. It it's kind of incomprehensible through words or pictures. So it was a little wild.
You've been there a handful of times, yes?
No, this is my first time.
Okay.
Spent a couple weeks, and I was with my mom. She really wanted to go and see. In her words, she says, I don't know how many good years I've got left, so let's go to Egypt. I said, okay, let's go to Egypt.
So she picked Egypt.
She picked Egypt,
just needed to see the pyramids?
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
Was it as cool as it was made out to be?
Like I said, it's kind of incomprehensible, and it really blows your mind in every way, because not only is the scale of these things so huge, but by being there and understanding that a lot of this was built 6,000 years ago, you start to realize the narrative of how you've assumed humanity has evolved is completely wrong.
Mm.
Right? We have this idea in our head that it's linear. That, you know, one day we went from all fours to 2 feet, and then we invented fire, and then someone made a wheel, and now we have AI, right? We kind of think that that's how it happened. And then when you get there, and when you see the scale and the intricacies and the way these things were built, and by that I mean, like, they were built in a way we don't understand. How did they move these gigantic pieces of rock and make them at perfect right angles if... You know, they weren't doing it with slaves and logs like we kind of think in our head. There was something else going on, and it just really made me think about how progression of all kinds is definitely not linear. There's always regression as part of progression, and very often sideways. And so whatever happened 6,000 years ago in Egypt was not at all a way that we can comprehend.
Aliens.
I hope so. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah. I'm actually reading a book right now called Project Hail Mary.
Oh, love that book.
You've read it?
Yes.
Okay. What's so fun about this book is, so if anybody doesn't know, it was written by the same guy that wrote Martian.
Yeah, Andy Weir.
Yeah. And also that amazing movie, Martian, which...
The Martian.
I can't remember who the actor was in that
Matt
movie.
Matt Damon.
Thank you.
Yes.
But so Project Hail Mary, yes. What I love most about it is that even the things that he talks about, obviously it's a fiction book,
mm-hmm.
but so much of it is like the factual things that are actually true about like mm-hmm. how gravity works mm-hmm. and acceleration works. And it was like,
yeah.
I'm like learning as I'm being vastly entertained yes. in this book. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's a great book. And I love how he conceptualized the alien. Again, it's in a way where we always view everything for our human experience, right? Mm. But this alien is conceived through, I mean, a little bit of a human experience, but mostly this alien idea, this alien body and world that he created. And I don't know how far you're into it, so I'm not going to...
Please don't.
No spoilers or anything, but it's just... We are one facet of the universe as humans, and so much else has happened, and I think it's important to... Think in different categories. Think how things might be if you were an eight-legged alien.
I just love the concept of zooming out. I was actually watching a new Netflix documentary about, and I rarely watch TV, but mm-hmm. this was about like sort of like the new version of planet Earth,
mm-hmm.
and it goes back millions of years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there was a statistic in there that literally still to this day explodes my brain, but it was talking about, if you look at how many creatures or living things there are on planet Earth right now, I think it's roughly like 10,000 living species of any kind on planet
That's
Earth.
That's it?
Right. And then when you take that into context, though, and you zoom out even farther from that, that's actually only 1% of all the species that has ever lived on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm. So there's been just tons of mass extinctions.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Like, we are a blip.
We're next, yes.
So if everything on planet Earth right now is less than 1% of what has existed, yeah. humans are like a fraction of a percentage of any sort of relevance to the planet Earth.
Yeah.
Which is like, my mind explodes when I hear stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not even in a morbid way. In a way of like, oh man, it kind of is like liberating to know like, mm-hmm. Whatever I do actually doesn't matter that much. I want to do cool things, but like, it doesn't really matter that much, like at the end of the day.
So. Yeah.
Anyways, this isn't a show about conspiracies or space or aliens or any of those things.
So maybe it should be.
I actually want to pull back on you, Brooke, because there's a few different angles that we could go from this, from obviously your cooking experience. You have some CrossFit background, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Some personal challenges, obviously, with mm-hmm. your health and family and prescription drugs and all those fun things. Mm-hmm. But I actually want to pull all the way back to like even like early childhood and like early experiences in life.
Okay.
What was it like just growing up in Nevada with your parents?
In Reno, Nevada. Yeah. So we're in Texas right now.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to a friend of mine who lives in LA, and I was just kind of saying, oh, you know, Austin's kind of a quirky little place. And he said, yeah, it is. The open carry thing makes me nervous, though. And I said, well, I grew up with a sniper rifle behind my couch, so whatever.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, and that was my stepdad's. And then my dad, you know, also kept guns, and we kept them for everything from bears to intruders to the apocalypse, right? And so the stuff to me is just kind of normal, but I only bring that up because, you know, my father was this huge character. I mean, the funny thing about the bears is that, yes, we had guns in the house in case a bear came, but then when the bear did come, he just stood in the driveway and threw bologna at it. And yeah, and then he called me and said, hey, go grab more bologna and come throw it at the bear. And we did, and it was great, and everyone's fine.
Was he trying to attract or scare the bear?
He was just delighted.
Okay, neither. He just wanted to feed Smokey the bear.
Yeah, it was the middle of the day. We had a lot of bears in our area, and this is, you know, not recommended by anyone, but he kind of had no fear and was just this person who huge personality, and he just determined, you know, that the bear wasn't going to hurt him and that it would be fun to feed the bear. So we did. And that was my father in a nutshell. And my mom, meanwhile, was this, you know, or is this really wonderful angel of a human, very educated and proper in manners. So, you know, I would be taught manners and politeness from her and how to act. And then I'd go throw bologna at bears with my dad. So it was this very kind of, you know, almost white and blue collar combined existence growing up, which I'm really glad I had.
Yeah, one of my good friends, Joel Cochran, lives in Reno. And
I know Joel.
Do you really?
Yes.
Proclivity?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's a good buddy of mine.
Yeah, he's a good buddy of mine too.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I used to go swing dancing with him at the rodeo.
Okay,
that's my swing dancing partner.
That is his thing.
He's so good at it.
Oh my gosh. When he was down here in Austin, it was this last summer. He, like, every day, he's like, are we going swing dancing tonight? And I was like, dude, I don't know. Like, what is your deal with the swing dancing?
Oh my God, I wish he was here. I want to go swing dancing in Austin.
I briefly actually invited him to come down for, I don't know if it was like Houston or San Antonio's rodeo or something like that, because he's obsessed with rodeos. Rodeos and like carrying guns around and wearing boots, I feel like, is very Joel. But
correct.
Yeah. That's crazy that you actually know him as well.
Yeah, like pretty well.
That's amazing. Well, I'll definitely have to share this episode with him. But
yes, we will take a selfie and just send it to him. No context.
Where was I going with this? Oh, so growing up in Reno with your parents, so were you like outside the city or what, like farm? Like, why were there bears?
Why were there bears? We had a little cat or a little house in Truckee, California, before Truckee became the haven where all the former San Francisco tech bros moved to. Oh. It was just this tiny, sleepy little town, and we had a house in the woods there. So my parents would basically, my dad traveled a lot for work. They worked together, my mom and my dad, and so he would.
What did they do?
They own a collection agency.
Collection agency, what is that?
So when people don't pay their bills, you gotta help them pay their bills, which.
They weren't the one actually serving papers, were they?
My dad was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he would travel all over Nevada and serve. And then my mom, it's fascinating because if you meet her, she's, like I said, she's an angel. She's, if everyone had the mom that my mom had, my mom is, we wouldn't have any problems in this world. And so she inherited the business from her father. And it was never her little girl's dream to run a collection agency, but it gave her the life to be able to raise me and have some flexibility. But she didn't want to do it in this kind of, there's such a negative connotation for collection agents, you know, she didn't want to take advantage of people or take away their house and screw them, right? So she basically would work with the debtors and help them get out of debt and help them fix their credit. And she taught everyone who worked with her to do the same. So it was this service for people that, yeah, got the clients paid, but it also helped the debtors with their financial situation. And it was really great. So she ran that for 40 years and they worked together. And so when my dad was off on motorcycles doing his job around the city or around the state, I'd be with my mom. And then when he came back, very often my mom would say, I need a break. And so my dad and I would go up to the cabin and throw bologna at bears.
Did you ever get involved in the collection business at all?
I knew from a very young age that I didn't want to take it over. That could have been an option to me if I had wanted to. I really knew I didn't. I knew I wanted to get out of Reno, but I would work there during the summers. There were some times when, you know, maybe there was a staffing shortage or something, and my mom would call and say, hey, can you come do this for a little while, especially when I was writing my book, because I wasn't, you know, working in a traditional job, so I could take some time and help her when she needed. And
is
so
it
on.
Pretty lucrative collection?
I think it can be. I know the rules have changed a lot over the years, but and it varies widely by state. But I think it's like anything else, right? You've got good business owners and bad business owners, so you can just as easily lose money as you can make it.
So when you were stepping in, did you actually have to personally deliver papers and stuff?
No, okay. No, that wasn't me. I was doing more like back end,
got it,
basic coding, okay, and filing and that sort of thing.
I'm trying to think of what the movie was where they like were like, yeah, he would like dress up into these like crazy outfits and have to deliver papers to people, and he would use these like outfits to sneak into parties and
they're just serve people. I don't know.
I'm just that's this vision I have when I think of like collections people, mm-hmm, is they have to like somehow like sneak their way into the house or building, and they're like, oh, by the way, you're served. Actually, you know who it was? It was the Interview, James Franco and Seth
Rogen?
Yes, Seth Rogen. It was one of his movies.
Oh, that sounds like it could be hilarious, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
But that wasn't your dad, like putting on random costumes to deliver papers?
No, I think in real life it's much more simple. You just ring the doorbell.
Okay.
Someone answers.
And they're like, hey, here you go. Pay this bill.
Yeah, or they're not home. I don't really know how it worked, but
interesting.
The goal was to do it without ever going to court because that was not fun for anyone.
Totally.
So
when did you get out of Reno then?
2004, I graduated high school and I went to Middlebury College in Vermont and was basically gone for 15 years, other than 15 years? I don't know. Basically gone for a decade and a half around there. Plus or minus coming back for holidays or whatnot.
How did you decide on that college?
So my dad had died when I was 15. And I kind of lost a lot of direction. And I was taken to a child psychiatrist who, and I was put on a bunch of antidepressants. And, you know, in retrospect, I think what that did is it just kind of made me not care too much about anything. And it also really, it really dampened my inner compass. And so I just didn't care, basically, where I went. And so Middlebury was on just a map of colleges in the New England area, and I knew I wanted to get as far away from Reno as possible, so I went to New England. And it was the second school we looked at, and I showed up there, and I looked around, and it looks like a postcard, and I said, I could go here. And I just said, I'm going to apply early decision to just this school, and if I don't get in, I'll still have time to apply other places. And so I applied early decision and got in and never applied to another school.
That's so interesting. This is probably a really weird spin on this conversation, okay, that we're having right now. But it's just making me think of, are you familiar with the Surrender Experiment, Michael Singer?
No, but I think I might intuit where you're going.
Yeah. There's this like degree of you just kind of, I mean, for lack of a better word, say fuck it.
Yeah.
And you just kind of let the universe takes you, uh-huh, as it will. Obviously there could be downsides to this, but it also probably puts you into interesting situations that you would never be in otherwise.
It does. And I think so. I actually have an interesting tangent on that I have not told you about. So with me at that time, most of my decisions were made out of the path of least resistance because I almost didn't feel in my body in the sense that I just really had no instinct because I was depressed. I didn't really want anything. I didn't really care about a future. So therefore, why would I make decisions to have a better one? It just kind of all seemed like life was meaningless, so it doesn't matter. And so that was, you know, a pretty negative interpretation of that surrender experiment, if you will. And I pretty much did that for most of the time that I was medicated and depressed, which was the better part of 15 years. And then when I was 30, I, you know, decided to get off these drugs and I went through antidepressant withdrawal, which is terrible, but I ended up, I was in Vancouver, Canada, completely randomly, and I was starting to heal. And I was starting to come out of it and starting to realize that I had made a lifetime of decisions through the lens of depression and antidepressants, and that I was in a default of basically saying no. So I said, okay, how do we reverse this? I said, I'm going to say yes to literally every single yes or no question I get. And my plan was to do it for a year, and I started tracking it. And it was as basic as if the coffee barista said, do you want cream and sugar in your coffee? I would say yes, even though I don't take cream and sugar in my coffee. It was like I forced myself to pay attention to every yes or no question and just see what happened. And I did it for 50 days, and two major things came from this experiment in 50 days. The first was that I met someone who would become a long-term partner. We're not together anymore, but it was a 5-year-long relationship. And the only reason why we met is because a friend of mine asked if I wanted to go to a sushi restaurant that was horribly inconvenient for me. And I said yes. And I sat down at that table very cranky about a great many things that day, and he sat down right next to me at the supper table, and by the end of the night we were chatting. So that was one. And then the other thing was actually my book, because I had no plans to write this book. I was lost and confused, but I had published a cookbook with my former business partner as part of our bakery. So I'd been through the publishing process in New York once before, and the literary agent at that time, I was chatting with her, and she was basically saying, I don't know what to do with my life or anything. And she goes, well, do you want to write a book about this experience? And I was like, oh, crap.
Yes, yes, I do.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes, I do. And all right. And that's when I stopped the experiment, because I was like, I got to write a book now. And 5 years later, it came out.
I got to share this with my buddy. My buddy has this expression that he says to me all the time. And he says, set your preferences aside. Mm-hmm. And he uses that on me all the time. And it works very well. Because like I think we all do, right? Like we all like prefer one thing over the other. And the most glaring example of this, I remember we were out in Washington State, and we were on a guy's camping, hiking trip in the middle of like the wilderness, basically. And we had to like return a vehicle, and it had to be there at like this specific time. And I was the one that organized all this trip. And I was like, yo, you guys, we got to like get up and go. And they're like playing spike ball, like dicking around. And he looks over at me and he's like, set your preferences aside, bro. And my mind just like exploded. And I was just like, in that moment, I was like,
this is good.
All right. Fuck it. I guess so. Yep. And then we ended up like returning it later and had to pay in a little extra fee because we had it longer. None of it actually mattered. Realistically, it was like, fuck it. But that's interesting. I'd be curious as to, of all those yeses, I guess you said to, are there any that stand out that are glaring to you, or ones you remember specifically?
I mean, those two in particular were the only two yeses that led to a major life change. And I guess those were two gigantic major life changes. I mean, I suppose I can't understell that. Everything else was pretty minor, though. It was just, do you want to go listen to this band? And no, I really don't want to go listen to this horrible band at midnight, you know? And then there were ones, you know, I was in Vancouver and there's a lot of homelessness there. And so I was walking home from the band, and some guy was like, asked me how much, if like, basically said, do you want to give me all your change? And I was like, oh, crap. So I had to give him all my money. You know, it was just little things. And really what it did is it really made me pay attention. You know, and I also, but I got also, I had rules, you know, you couldn't ask me to do something that would take advantage of me or the experiment. Like someone couldn't say, do you want to give me all your money? No. You know, I could say no to things like getting a face tattoo if I didn't want to do that, right? Like things that would have permanent repercussions, I was allowed to say no to. But for the most part, it was just little things, and I didn't really realize the impact of either going to that sushi restaurant or writing this book until, you know, many months later anyway.
Have you ever reversed the experiment and said no to everything for a long time?
I mean, that was the first, you know, that was from 15 to 30.
That was really? You just say pretty no much to everything?
It wasn't no to everything. It was like I would say yes to the path of least resistance, which led me into a lot of situations that I wasn't inherently happy with. You know, I owned a business that was, I was pretty miserable in, and a business partnership that was pretty miserable. I made a lot of choices that it was just, you know, I just don't think were very good for me. And so, but I was still, you know, living every day. Like I was waking up and putting one foot in front of the other. But beyond that, as far as actually having curiosity, trying new things, thinking that there was, you know, light and excitement in the world, that was all just an inherent no, you know?
I'd be curious as to what the balance is in there. Is that like, and I'll buy you some time to think about this question, but really what I'm wondering is like, how do you determine your yeses and no now? And the reason that I ask that question is because I think that for the human brain, we love to live in a black and white world. Mm-hmm. We love right, wrong, good, bad, yes, no, but we don't. And that's what is hard. And that's what gives most people anxiety, mm-hmm. is that there is no black and white really ever for anything. Yeah. And so I'm curious though, then, like, how do you vet for that stuff now?
Now I've had to learn to move it from an intellectual decision to a physiological decision. So, and I often find that the more I have to think about something, the more I'm trying to just talk myself into it. And if I just listened to my body's physiology, it would have given me the answer a week or a month ago.
Hey guys, Corey here, real quick. Sorry for the interruption, but I just want to let you know, if you happen to be watching this podcast episode as opposed to just listening to it, you're about to realize that we actually lost the video for the rest of this episode, partly because I forgot to put my phone, which I record on, into do not disturb mode and somebody called me, and also partly because the GoPro happened to freeze halfway through this episode. I have no idea why, but luckily the microphones both worked perfectly, and so if you're listening to the show, then don't really worry about the video piece of it, but if you are watching this, I don't let it deter you from listening to the rest of the show, because it really is a great conversation. But enough about that. All right, back to the episode.
This is kind of what I learned. You know, when I went through antidepressant withdrawal and I came out of it, I pretty much had nothing. I didn't have a job. I didn't have an address. I didn't have much money. I didn't have anything to tether me to the world. And I felt like I was in a completely new body after being medicated for 15 years. And I didn't even know what I liked. I couldn't tell you what food I liked or what music I liked to listen to, because my tastes had so radically changed and I was just spit out a totally new person. And so I didn't totally trust my thinking either, because my thinking had been clouded by all the years of medication and in effect, all the wrong decisions I had made that were clearly bad for me. And so it became, okay, how do we do this differently? And so I decided to start feeling my way through the world a little bit more. And that's taken many years to hone. But now, the simplest way I can explain it, there's really two things that happen to me. One is, do I feel expanded or do I feel contracted when I think of something? And that manifests in a very physical feeling for me. And so if I feel expanded, usually what happens is I will kind of get a little cold. I'll feel like a chill went down my spine, kind of just like, almost if like you imagine you're kind of in a bubble most of the time and then the bubble suddenly pops and you can just feel the atmosphere. And it's subtle. Sometimes it's not subtle, but it can be subtle. And then it's like, okay, that's the sign that this is an expansive decision. And then on the flip side, when it's not an expansive decision, usually one of two things will happen. I will either feel, sometimes I'll just get physically nauseous. Like if I sit there and I kind of get quiet and I say, okay, should I do A or B? And if I think about A, maybe I get a little tingly. If I think about B, if I sit there for 30 seconds, I'll actually start to physically feel my stomach churn and get nauseous. Or if that doesn't happen, there's just a literal sense of like, if we're talking about that bubble, it almost feels like instead of that bubble popping for a moment and feeling the atmosphere, it's like it just sucks in on me, like someone just vacuum sealed me and I just feel tight. And that can be really obvious and that's a strong no. But the problem then is your intellect gets involved. And so I had to say no to something very lucrative recently, and I was just like, but the money. And I said no because then I tried to talk myself into it for 4 hours. And finally I just said, this is stupid. And as soon as I fully officially said no, I felt a lot better.
That's usually a trigger for me as well, is like if I have to convince myself mm-hmm. of something.
Or ask a lot of other people for their opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You often already know.
Yeah.
You're
just not ready to admit it to yourself.
For sure.
Usually because you're scared.
It's funny that you talk about the expansive piece of it. That's actually literally a conversation Joel and I had when we were on the show. So that's funny that you guys both talk about that. He actually...
Wait, has he been on the show?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll put it in the show notes. But it was like one of my favorite conversations, because like he was literally like coaching me on the interview, because like I was dealing... It was actually literally one of the reasons I'm still doing this podcast show was because of that conversation, was like understanding like, this is very expansive for me. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a very fun thing for me, and I really enjoy mm-hmm. it a lot. And mm-hmm. so he's like, well, then, yeah, like, do more of that, essentially. I was mm-hmm. like, well, all right, that makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, follow the curiosity. Follow the tingliness.
Yeah. So speaking of that, I know you have tried and dabbled and learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
And one of those things, though, well, two questions. One, I'd be curious of, like, all these skills, which I love mm-hmm. skill development. It's my favorite thing in the mm-hmm. world. I feel like it's like real life video games. But of all the things you've done, which one is your favorite? And my second part to that question, you can take either or,
okay,
is like, have you ever done stand-up?
Funny story. Okay. So I have not. So in that yes experiment I did, I didn't tell a lot of people about it. But one person I did tell about it just decided to play with me a little bit and literally said, do you want to do stand-up? And I was like, no, I don't.
Oh, you said no?
Well, I said yes, but I never actually did it because the book got signed, or I signed the book deal and I started writing the book. And there was a part of me that was just like, I so don't want to do this, that the fact that the experiment is over means I don't have to. And there's always been a part of me that's been like, well, you've crapped out about that. So maybe at some point in my life, I'll give it a shot. But I don't think I'm funny, and I love performing, but that just stand-up sounds terrifying.
It's horrible. I've done it.
Yeah. Oh, it's painful. God, it sounds painful. I'd rather do almost anything. Improv. Get my teeth drilled. Yeah.
It's one of the most emotionally painful things, mm-hmm. for sure. There's very few things that are worse than bombing on stage. And you will bomb on stage because yes. you have no idea what the fuck
no.
you're doing.
No.
Yeah.
And you don't actually want to be there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The only reason I brought that up is like, don't take this the wrong way, but there is a lot of like parallels between depression and comedy.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's the only reason I brought it up, is that like you often see comedians using their comedy as their source of dealing with their depression.
Well, yeah. I mean, and how unoriginal, well, maybe it would be completely original, but nobody goes to a comedy show and wants to see someone just stand up there and say, I'm doing great.
Yeah, things are great.
Things are great.
Awesome.
Like, really, no problems at all. How are you?
Yeah, exactly.
Although maybe that would work. I don't know. Twist it up.
Maybe that is true. It's rather, like, what are all my problems? Or are they just like, they're just very vulgar and they bash everyone and yeah. everything. Like, those are yeah. kind of the two approaches, I feel like.
Or they make commentary on society, but when you actually hear how really good comics work, they spend a year working on one joke, and that's just, that's good for them. It's not how I want to spend my time, but maybe fair. I need to do it because I have resistance. Who knows?
You'll learn something. I did it a handful of times because like I did it once and I didn't feel like I really got what I wanted out of it in yeah. terms of like, I wanted to learn something.
Yeah.
And then after I did it a handful of times, I was like, okay, I have so much more respect for comedians. It's yeah. unbelievable.
How much or how long was your set?
It was always like open mic nights. So they're like usually like 2-3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes.
At least with that, you're in a cohort of other people who yeah. probably suck terribly. Oh, yeah. Everyone and was you terrible. Don't have a warmed up audience, and it's a very friendly introduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah. Well, that's probably one of the biggest things I learned was that like you have to read your audience mm-hmm. because there was very clear some things I tried one night would not work another night, and then they would work a different night, and I was like, okay, this is interesting.
That's so confusing.
Yeah. So you have to know your audience, which yeah. is honestly one of the reasons why like big comedians can then begin to fill out rooms, is because they understand mm-hmm. that humor. So they're going yeah. there for a very specific reason because they understand that humor. Yeah. So they're all like-minded, I guess you could yeah. say, which is really interesting yeah. psychology. But, okay, so then what, you didn't do stand-up.
No, I didn't.
So then of all the things you tried, learned, skill development, which one was your favorite?
So much of what I've done in the past 7 years has been as a direct result of being depressed for my entire 20s and not having, feeling like I missed everything. So I feel like I'm scrambling to experience as much as I can because my dad died at 53, so I'm kind of like, no one knows, right? Just learn as much as you can. So I started trying to learn one new skill a year and actually take classes in it and specifically make sure that it had nothing to do with my actual career, because that wasn't the point. The point is not to use it to make more money. It's to enrich my experience in the world. So I probably, my favorite thing that I've done so far is oil painting. And the reason why it's my favorite is because I've had an instinct to do it for many, many years and had not had the right setup or time or room or anything to do it. And finally last year I got to do it, and I've been kind of obsessed in a way that's like, there's something in me that wants to do it. So it feels not just like I am learning a skill in order to make the world a little bit more interesting, but learning something and almost doing something that I intuitively already know how to do and just expressing it. And I also feel that after writing my book and publishing it, I'm just kind of exhausted on writing as a creative outlet. So not using words and instead using a paintbrush is scratching the creative itch, but in a way that's completely different. So
you a Bob Ross fan?
I don't do Bob Ross style paintings, but there is a coffee shop in town that puts Bob Ross on, and I'll just sit there with my latte and watch him paint in happy trees.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
I know. I painted a Bob Ross before. I used to live in Minnesota, and it was like the weekend before I moved down here. My brother and I painted some Bob Ross. It was a good time.
Some good bonding.
It was great bonding, actually.
Give them to your mom. Hang them side by side.
Well, his looked way better than mine because he's definitely done way more Bob Rosses than I have. It was clearly my first because it was terrible.
Yeah, I do weird. Well, I don't know. I mean, some people think it's weird. I do more, like, it's not abstract. I do more cubist, futurist, colorful stuff.
Creative.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Sure.
Abstract.
A lot of geometry.
Oh, you like shapes.
Well, there are a lot of shapes in my art.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's a pain in the ass.
That's odd.
I mean, it's just trying to get a straight line with an oil paint and get hundreds of them in one painting is an exercise in patience, which is not something I'm particularly strong at. So maybe that's why I'm doing it.
Crazy. Let's reverse a little bit. Let's go back to maybe somewhere between Vancouver or college. I'd be curious as to, like, what was your first kind of business entrepreneurship endeavor? Obviously, your parents had their own business, but what about, like, when did you take it into your own hands?
Well, when I was 5, I started selling cookies at the local construction site.
Oh, damn.
Because I identified that other kids had lemonade stands, and they put them on the side of the road, and my thought process was, why would you put a lemonade stand next to a place where people are in their cars going past you at 30 miles an hour? Why not just go to the place where men are hot and hungry and give them cookies? And so that's what I did. I just went to the local construction site and just set out my little umbrella. There's the lovely Polaroid of me, and I would sell cookies and lemonade. And I sold out very quickly. And that was my first business endeavor.
So was that like the seed being planted? Because you eventually had like a bakery, right?
Yeah, I did.
Was that like the seed that was planted to eventually lead to getting a bakery?
Probably. I think I did establish two things very early on. One, and so I came from a family of entrepreneurs too with my family. So I kind of identified that I was probably always going to do something a little bit different. And also that for me, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are really lazy at heart. You want to get as much as you can with as little effort as possible. And there was something in my construction lemonade stand where I realized I can make twice as much money with half the work just by going to a better location.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been, you know, a weird theme of my whole career, as unflattering as it is to say out loud.
I've heard before too that if you could control, like, basically all the metrics in terms of, like, how many people are there or, like, what kind of product you have or what kind of service you have, that, like, the most important one by far is a starving crowd.
Yes.
Is, like, if you have the worst cookie stand or lemonade stand on the planet, it is irrelevant if everyone there is hungry and thirsty.
Yep, that's correct.
That's super smart.
Yeah, and so and when it came to the bakery, it was like, okay, how do we... It was all about controlling the narrative and being different because we primarily sold alcoholic cupcakes. So we had...
You sold alcoholic cupcakes.
Yeah. And during Peep Cupcake in the 2010s. And...
Why was that Peep Cupcake season or year or...
There was like...
Shows?
No. I don't know what happened, but there was this cupcake boom that happened. I mean, you had the Sprinkles franchise suddenly appeared. You had Georgetown Cupcakes being aired on TV. It was kind of before the Corona, there was the cupcake.
Interesting.
And there was a whole bunch of them in New York, and we kind of got in right at the start of all that. But there, you know, I have a high-end culinary background, so I was used to working in kitchens with, you know, little spheres of mango juice and, you know, something that looked like an egg but tasted like cake, you know, stuff like that. So so pretentious. So I brought that high-end culinary mindset to kind of the humble cupcake. So and my business partner was a bartender. So we came together and said, okay, well, we are going to create cupcakes, little mini cupcakes based on cocktails, but we want them to be really elegant, really balanced, purely for adults and not for college kids who want to get drunk on cake. We're going to make it, you know, to be served at high-end places. And, you know, we did Broadway, we did Google, celebrities would buy them for their birthday parties or whatever because they were beautiful as and they were elegant and they were such an adult and different flavor profile. And so we pretty much controlled everything around that narrative and just marketed towards a very specific crowd. And given that we were selling $2 cupcakes in Manhattan, we did pretty well.
How long did the business last?
So I sold my half of it after 5 years, and then the rest of it formally closed just before the pandemic.
What happened?
I think my ex-business partner, she just kind of decided.
Called it quits?
Yeah. She had gotten involved in other things at that point, and Peak Cupcake had been replaced by Peak Cronut, and it was time.
Well, I just recently learned the story of Crumble, if you're familiar with them.
The cookies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's $1 billion business now.
Yeah. And things have really changed in the quick food industry. I mean, yeah. Especially since the 2010s when, you know, I was in that world. But I think from what I hear, Crumble's kind of a great example of just a starving audience. Not necessarily the best cookie. Sorry.
And they actually create their own demand. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a cookie expert in any way, shape, or form. I actually don't care for sweets all that much in general. But really their differentiator, though, is what blew them up, I should say, is that they created scarcity and urgency by having a rotating cookie circuit, basically.
Yeah.
So you can only get these cookies during this week or month or whatever it is. Genius.
And then, but is it really that genius, though? I mean, we had that. We would have rotating stuff in specials all the time. I think, and I don't think that's new, right? I mean, literally soup of the day.
True.
I think that the difference is that it clearly wasn't Instagram. I think it must have been when TikTok really started taking off, is now we have the kind of virality of food that we didn't quite have, and in a very transient way.
Their food porn is 10 out of 10.
Yeah. So that's what I think. Then you combine that with the scarcity, and that's when you get it. I mean, we're seeing that, with the Stanley Cup thing that's been happening. It's the same thing.
Yeah. I don't follow sports. I don't know what you're talking about, but yeah.
There's the mug thing.
I know what the Stanley Cup is. Yeah. But are you saying like because you can put your name on it because of the rings, or what do you mean?
No. So I am not too well versed in this either, but someone was telling me about it. Like, so not Stanley Cup, like the hockey award, but it's like travel mug.
Actual Stanley.
Yeah, and the people going bonkers over having to have 75 in different colors to match their outfit, and because they're doing weekly drops of a different color, and you're just like, this is nuts that this is working, and it's so transparent.
Yeah, and I think I agree, because I think that the social media creates the craving, and then the scarcity like pushes you over the edge to make the purchase.
Yeah,
so I think you do need both.
And then if you have the team, you have to have the team behind it to plan and actually execute that.
Yeah, because did you see their TikTok where they bought that girl a car? See that?
No.
Some girl's car burnt down, and the only thing that survived was her Stanley.
God.
And so, like, the owner or CEO, whatever, got on TikTok, and he was like, "Hey, glad to see your Stanley survived. We're going to send you a new one and buy you a car."
Yeah, and then in this day and age, that just kaboom, right? Yeah. And that's just, that's different than it was even 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's the TikTok effect, really.
I like that. So was the cupcake business the first official go at entrepreneurship? I mean, other than the cookies, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was 24, 25.
What could you maybe teach us about that experience that would be helpful to others that you maybe now do with your own endeavors?
How do I say this? I think when I was 25, I hadn't quite honed that expansion, contraction, intuition yet. And I made a lot of decisions. This is when I was talking about making decisions based on path of least resistance rather than the right one. And so, you know, my business partner and I were not great business partners. And I knew that really early on. And it was unfortunate because we were friends, and we would both say today that we ruined our friendship by going into business together. And you're basically going into a marriage with someone. So you better treat it like you're going into a marriage with someone. And that's the biggest thing that I wish that somehow we had done differently. And, you know, it's kind of shitty to say that in retrospect too, because it was because of the both of us being involved that we created the very cool business we had. And we certainly both contributed to it, but neither one of us would say that that was a particularly pleasant or fulfilling experience. And it we created a lot of pain for each other. So I've been very careful to choose business partners and clients differently since then. And I probably overcorrected a little bit, but I so don't want to go through an experience like that again. And so I think if you've got reservations about something early, you really have to make the harder choice to trust that your instinct is right there, rather than move forward just because it's easier to have a partner or this person has the connections you need or whatever it is.
I think a lot of us make that mistake early on, honestly.
Yeah, he's got rose-colored glasses on mm-hmm. at that point. So mm-hmm. no real problems yet.
Right.
Yeah.
On top of the fact of like, it's money, fuck it, let's do it.
Right.
You don't realize the repercussions of something like that from an emotional time standpoint.
Yeah, an emotional time standpoint. And it's all you. It's all on you. I think I know that when I was making those decisions early on, it was like, well, there's no real consequences right now. I think that you can undo things easily in the beginning. But the whole point of starting a business is you're building a foundation. So if you build the wrong foundation, then it's just going to make everything harder.
And this was, you were in New York this whole time?
Mm-hmm.
Brooklyn?
We were in the Lower East Side, our business, yeah.
And that was, so the entire time you were living in New York, you had this business?
Most of the time, yeah.
Okay. Real short in terms of like, I know nothing about New York.
Mm-hmm.
You lived there for a handful of years, obviously.
Yeah, I was there for 8 years.
Favorite and worst, or yeah, most favorite, least favorite part about New York?
Most favorite part is just, I just kind of feel alive there. I love being surrounded by people who are doing interesting things and who have ambition and who aren't shy about having ambition. And that it's just, you're either doing really well or you're in the absolute gutter and emotionally, and sometimes, you know, I think that the reason why I wouldn't say that in retrospect, I didn't thrive emotionally, but I did think I did so much better there in my 20s because I was, you know, I was depressed, I was medicated, and yet there's still enough going on there that still kind of made me feel alive. I think if I had been living in Reno and I was in that state, it would have been really bad news because there was nothing to hold my attention. There wasn't any creativity or anything interesting. So on the other hand, you kind of have paradox of choice, and it can be really overwhelming, and it's noisy all the time, and there's just very little peace, and I can't imagine that it's good for your nervous system or your, you know, your physical health at all. But I'm the kind of person where if I had a perfect world, I would have an apartment in New York City and then a cabin in the middle of nowhere, and I would just split my time as I wanted.
50-50? How do you think you'd spend that time?
I think it would depend year to year. Some years I'd be 70 in the cabin not talking to anyone, and some years I'd be 70% in my apartment in New York just walking very quickly down the street.
The funny thing is, for people that don't really know me on a personal level, mm-hmm. like they'll see that I do a lot of community building and I'm very involved in Austin here specifically. Mm-hmm. And they have this assumption, and I hear it all the time, that like I'm like extroverted and love to be around people. But anybody that knows me personally, mm-hmm. I spend 95% of my mm-hmm. time alone.
Same.
And I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's the best.
Yeah. Most people don't know that about me. So your question or your answer about cabin and New York, I feel like I'd be in the cabin all the time.
Yeah.
And then, like when there's an event, I was like, all right, fuck it.
Then I'll go there. You know, because when you're like this, I'm like this too, is it doesn't take a lot of social interaction for my cup to feel full.
No.
So I'm like, oh, I had one conversation this week. Excellent. See you later.
That's exactly how I feel about it.
Yeah.
That's why this show is one episode a week. People that can do like 2-3 episodes and like, good on you. That is not me.
No.
So anything else in terms of like, actually, I was going to ask you, I forgot. How are you managing your emotions at time when you were running the business in New York, obviously dealing with a lot of things emotionally? I mean, was it running? Was it working out? Was it like getting in a sauna? Was it writing? Like, what were you doing to manage your emotions at that time?
Those are all such enlightened answers.
Okay.
I wasn't doing any of that.
Drinking.
Yes, I was drinking. I don't think I was really, I wasn't having really any emotion other than boredom and occasionally outrage because I was so down, I was so depressed, and I was so medicated that I certainly couldn't feel excitement. There was no room for creativity. And so I was literally feeling like every day my only goal was to pass the time until the next day. And so I didn't have any affect really one way or the other. So if I never was able to experience enough depth of emotion to process emotion. So the things that did make me feel a little different is, I mean, New York has a big drinking culture, so I definitely drank a lot, and I also owned a boozy bakery, so it was completely appropriate to pour a bourbon or something, you know, at 5 PM while you were still open. Nobody cared. And I was 20 and or 25. And then I did start, you know, I have a big athletic background. I was a very serious dancer growing up, and I was a springboard diver in college. And so I did recognize that I wasn't going to be able to own a bakery and feel good about myself. So I started doing CrossFit just because I needed to work out, and I needed to work out hard in order to offset cake. And so I did find a bit of a community there. I was able to change my relationship with my body through that. But even that, it was not something I did as, you know, for my mental health, as people say. It was something I did because I wanted to fit in my pants.
So I wanted to touch on it earlier, because this is something I've actually talked about as well, is that I've had depression a few times in my life, but they've always been circumstantial. Like something has happened and it spiraled me into a pretty dark hole. And but there's one in particular that stands out more than any of them, and I would think I was like 16 at the time. Girl broke up with me, like suicidal, super depressed. And it's crazy to look back at that, and I think about this all the time, is that the thing that literally saved me was working out.
Yeah.
But I reflect often that it could have been anything.
Yeah.
Is like when you're in a vulnerable state, is like it could be anything.
It's consistency. It's a pattern.
For sure. And so I'm very grateful that was like the outlet that happened. And it was all honestly because my mom, she saw and she like invited me to the gym. And that was her way of, like, I guess helping, which obviously it did. But it was, like, I know, like, how vulnerable you can be in that circumstance. And, like, it could be drugs. It could be weed. It could be sex. It could be porn. It could be anything, right? Is like, I do feel like I got very lucky in that sense.
I think about this a lot because we've got so many tools now. And technology is taking us to a place where we're basically trying to outsource mundane activities, right? Don't have to vacuum your house because you have a Roomba, you know, that sort of thing. But what that does is just free up tons of time for people to ruminate and or spend time doing things that do not actually bring you a sense of satisfaction or completion. And I'm not sure if that's a big contributor to what we're seeing right now, but it's certainly a contributor, because you come home and your house is clean and someone's done the dishes for you and there's nothing for you to do. Well, you just stand there and what, either
scroll,
dick around on your phone. Yeah. Or have plenty of time to think about how terrible your life is, as opposed to back before all this. Then, well, it was a household, you know, everyone in the household together would work to do the dishes, clean the house, do chores. There would be menial tasks that are, I think, so beneficial for the brain. There's something you had to do every day to make sure the house was kept together, or, you know, jobs just took longer so you didn't run out of tasks every day. I mean, and so I think that that is part of it. And so for me, you know, I definitely was not, just sitting at home was not good for me. And so being in a gym, I mean, I just felt better. So I guess I kind of was doing it for my mental health, but that didn't feel like it at the time. It felt very vain at the time. And then I just liked that beating up my body felt good, because again, I couldn't really feel a lot of things. So, but I could feel breathing hard in the gym and getting stronger and having a goal.
I think a lot of people figured that out during the whole pandemic deal.
Yeah.
Was like how stressful not having anything to do can actually be on your psychology.
Yeah. And how playing video games for 8 hours really doesn't help you that much.
No. Yeah. It is very unfulfilling. Yeah, it is something that I reflect a lot on, even especially I think a lot of just people who run their own business or kind of have like autonomy over their time run into the same issue very often. I know that I do as well, is like reflecting back. I think this is a really important question for people to answer, is like, how do you want to spend your time? And not judging whether that's like right or efficient or wrong or good or bad. Is like, I can think of many things on my list that I could hire, outsource, delegate. But I don't want to, because it's like, it's how I like to spend my time. I feel like my favorite example of this is, like, do you know Casey Neistat? He's a massive YouTuber, and he's been like doing the vlogging style YouTubes. He lives in New York for like, I think like 20 years now. He's like an OG of YouTube. And then there's Mr. Beast, if you're familiar with. So he's on the other end of the spectrum of like, Mr. Beast has this like massive team, giant production, all these people. And then you have Casey Neistat, who's also a YouTuber, and it's just him. Also has millions of followers. He does all the editing, filming, everything himself. And he basically was like, I like doing these things. Why would I give it up? And I think that's a really important people or a question for people to figure out is like, how do you like to spend your time? And just optimizing around that, as opposed to like, how do I make more money? How do I delegate? How do I automate? It's like, well, do you want to? Like, that's way more important. So leading forward into, back to your story then, in terms of starting the coaching business, in terms of like doing
the performance cooking stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to know, how did you get into that and where did that start?
Yeah, so my day job is I'm a private chef for professional athletes and high performers. And that started, I mean, I've always been in the culinary industry. Went to culinary school after college and then, you know, worked in the fancy restaurants and then the bakery. And then, but I've always kind of had these two lives and where I had all of this extensive food experience. And then also I had this extensive athletic experience. And it's only been in the past few years that I've really figured out how to bring them together. And that's just because I started working for a company doing basically recipe development. And what they specialized in was, you know, macros. They started off as a company that was specifically helping weightlifters and people who needed to cut weight in a healthy way for their competition without, you know, dropping too much weight and passing out, and also helping them stay at a more manageable weight all the time so they weren't yo-yoing. And eventually they expanded out to, you know, more, less, you know, people who weren't athletes who just wanted to maintain a better, a more ideal weight for them. And so they hired me to come on and basically say, okay, there's, you have to cook differently if you're cooking for macros. And so I started getting really good at and just churning out recipes that were focused on, you know, maybe this one's high protein, low carb, maybe this one's high protein, high fat, low carb, maybe this one's high fat, low carb, low protein, right? Because macros become a puzzle. And so after that, I got involved with the XPT organization. So that's Laird Hamilton started that. And I'm one of their coaches in that, you know, I have some experience just with all these folks in CrossFit. And a lot of people are at kind of the edges of some of the more, you know, the things that are trendy in health and wellness now. I feel like we were talking about 6-7 years ago. And so through that, you know, I just started, I've always been cooking. And so my name got passed around and I started working with a Major League Baseball player who needed some specific help with his food. And that's what started it. And now, you know, I've been working with him for the past few seasons and I usually only take 1 to 2 clients at a time because it's such bespoke work, but I've worked with a variety of high performers and athletes, and we literally look at their labs and we make choices for what they need based on their labs and whatever their goal is, whether or not that's to, you know, cut weight if you're a wrestler, or maintain your energy if you're a golfer, or just figure out how to eat well because you're on the road for 162 games a year. So it definitely changes per person.
Are you traveling with these people?
No. So I have actually created a system where I do it all remotely. So I'm pretty much like someone's personal HelloFresh or trifecta. So I cook everything in my house. It's just me. I'm overseeing every aspect of what these people put in their body. And I'm cooking it, portioning it, vetting it. And then we pack it on dry ice and send it out to them. So they get a shipment every 1 to 2 weeks. And it's great for my athletes because, I mean, if you're a baseball player and you're getting home at 11 o'clock at night, you probably don't want to deal with someone in your house at that point, or dishes or whatever it is. And then if you're on the road a lot, then you don't have to worry about things spoiling. If things change based on training schedule or volume, we can change things. And people don't have to have people in their house if that's not what they want.
So this is very personal, high touch, few clients,
yeah,
premium offer.
Yeah.
What's the downside of this business? Is it scalable?
It's not scalable. And I don't really want to scale it, at least at this point, because there are two reasons why I don't want to scale it. The first is that I have to like the person I work with or work for. I mean, if I'm going to spend, you know, a good chunk of my time thinking about you, I better like you. You know, and if I don't, then I'm going to be bitter. It shows up in the food. I mean, I can tell if I'm in a bad mood, even if it has nothing to do with the person I'm cooking for. The food is shit. Sometimes I have to redo it just because it's like, it's energy. It's a literal and emotional transfer of energy. And so it's so important to me to really like that person. And then I also need to be kind of in tune with them. It's easier with an athlete because I can literally watch their games and kind of see how they're doing. And then we talk little less. It's more difficult for me if I'm working with a, you know, CEO or someone where I'm not seeing their performance every day. And I just kind of have to go either both on gut feel and what they're telling me. But so it's highly not scalable because of that, just the amount of time it takes. And then I also, at this point, I just don't trust other people because what we're dealing with is really specific. So, you know, in the case of athletes, we have to be careful. I mean, if there's any sort of, you know, allergy or sensitivity, that stuff's pretty obvious. But if you're getting drug tested, then, you know, you can't just be going and pulling an almond milk off the shelf that's fortified with vitamins and minerals from an untested facility, because there's a chance that it's slightly tainted and you could pop a drug test, right? So,
really?
Yep.
In oat milk?
Yep. Because you know how you see on the side of the little ingredients label, it says like fortified with vitamin D and K. Yeah. Those are probably not coming from sports safe third parties that have been tested. And athletes, the smart ones are just uber careful because there have been multiple athletes who've gotten, you know, tagged for various things, and they say it's a supplement thing, and then nobody believes them. They think they're juicing, their reputation's ruined, and it's just not worth it. So
wild.
I know that, like, when I go to the grocery store and I'm shopping for people, I'm rarely buying things in a package anyway, but if for some reason I am, then at least I know that I'm the one, I know exactly what I'm looking for to make sure we're not going to have a chance of being in a risky territory. And then, you know, on the flip side, if I'm helping someone who's maybe trying to recover from an illness, then you could literally hurt them by, you know, feeding them the wrong thing. I've got a client right now who has an extremely limited diet because he's trying to get better. And it's to the point where the only fat we can use is ghee. So if I, you know, if I hired someone and I said, okay, do this, do that, but they grab the olive oil instead, and I don't know, it's just, I'm not willing to put my client in the position of
olive
hurting
oil?
Them.
That seems super rare. Wow.
What?
They're sensitive to olive oil?
They're sensitive to everything right now. I mean, we're slowly building things back in, but we've got about half a dozen foods on our list primarily.
What's the law, super random fucking question, yeah, on raw milk where you live?
In Nevada, it's illegal. We can't have raw milk there, yeah. So if I go get raw milk, I have to drive across the border.
How crazy is that?
So stupid. But you can buy it. So I can buy some raw products that are labeled for pets.
Like what?
Kefir, specifically.
What?
It's in the lower corner and has this big label. It says for pets, and there's all these warnings that say it's not for human consumption, but to balance your pet's microbiome. And so I just buy that and drink it. It's fine.
Can't you just like find a farmer where you live?
I tried to rent a cow. It failed.
Really? You think that would be a thing?
You'd think? I mean, maybe that's my next business. Rent a cow?
Yeah. Because I can't remember the exact time frame on it, but like, yeah, there's like certain states that are finally coming around and letting you have raw milk again and stuff, but it is very interesting.
Yeah, the insurance on renting a cow would be nuts, but yeah, I don't know. It makes no sense. You can get it here, I think, right? In Texas?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Basically most, especially in Austin, like almost, it's actually, we have the reverse problem. Mm. Everybody buys it. Mm. So you actually have to like go early.
Or, find it.
Yeah. Or that's like awesome. Know the farmer because everyone wants it here.
It tastes totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the health proponents, if anyone wants to look it up, or bananas, it's hilarious. Yeah. If you actually look into the story of like why we banned it and yada yada, it's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Like so many things.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's high touch, premium clients, obviously not ready to start hiring anybody. You're doing everything all yourself. This must limit the types of foods that you can make since you're freezing it and shipping it, right? I mean, you can't freeze and ship everything.
You know, it doesn't because I'm working with high performance people. So most of the things that don't freeze well are not things I'd want to be feeding them anyway. So, you know, cream sauces are going to separate when you freeze them, but I'm not doing a pasta cream sauce. Same with, you know, pasta, for example. Most of the cooking I do is gluten-free and dairy-free with the exception of fermented dairy. And so that stuff is just, it freezes extremely well. And the, you know, I flash freeze it so that you don't really lose any quality. And then I also will cook it in a way where if you're reheating it, you know, I mean, we've all had a steak that was, God, it was perfect at a restaurant and then terrible when you microwaved it the next day, right? But if we if we just sear it so it gets to medium rare when they heat it up, you know, there are kind of ways around that stuff.
Is there a lot of competition?
Not within the space I'm in. I mean, in part because there are very few chefs who understand performance, and there are very few people who make, who understand performance, who can cook well. And so the hardest part is really just, it's just connecting client to client. I mean, because either I'm turning people down, which sucks, or, you know,
what do they do in that scenario? Like, where do they go?
If they're turning people down?
Yeah, like if you were to say no to somebody, like how many, like you're like, do you have referrals? Like how do you?
I don't. I mean, there are a group of people who really want this service, and there just aren't that many people.
So there's an opportunity here.
There's an opportunity. It's definitely a specific skill set though, and you really have to understand it.
Yeah, not suck at cooking, and also understands there's a nutritional macronutrient value.
Yeah, and then in the cooking aspect of it, it's a different. Like the folks I know who I went to culinary school with would probably struggle in this type of cooking because you have to break a lot of traditional culinary rules in order to...
Give me an example.
Gluten-free cooking is a really good example, at least gluten-free baking. You know, if you're working with a gluten-free dough, it doesn't act like a dough with flour, and you have to get used to it, and you have to know, you know, which flours you can use to get the result you want, and it's not particularly intuitive.
I have a really important sourdough question.
Okay, I may or may not be able to answer that.
Do you know much about sourdough? Maybe not. Maybe I'm asking
the right question. Probably more than the average person, but I'm not a professional sourdough baker, and I wasn't obsessed with sourdough during the pandemic, so.
Okay.
What's the question?
The whole, like, pulling and stretching.
Yeah.
Kneading. What does that do?
It basically creates long chains of gluten, so.
Why is that important?
Because, you know, chewy, okay. So you know that when you're eating cake versus bread or versus sourdough?
For sure.
If you literally look at it, there's no, we call this a crumb. So the cake, if you look at it, there's literally a crumb. If you take a fork and kind of agitate the cake, it falls out in little crumbs. So that's very short crumbs. So we haven't, there's not a lot of gluten formation in a cake because who wants a chewy cake? But with a bread, you really want that chew. So you need to create a lot of gluten, and formation, the way you do that is through agitation. And so with the sourdough bread, if you don't do that, then not only does it not rise and it not bake particularly well, but you won't get that smooth chew or the open holes that you want.
My girlfriend's gonna be so happy when she hears this episode. So I've gone back and forth from making sourdough many times, and I'm back in it again. And if you probably didn't see it, I posted today of the two sourdough loaves that I made and she made.
Okay.
And mine looks like a pancake.
Yeah.
And hers looks like this like round dough of bread.
Did you just kind of stir it together?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Like there wasn't a lot of stretching.
Okay, so you should stick to Irish soda bread. That's going to be your bread of choice.
Irish soda bread?
Irish soda bread.
What is that?
It's just a type of bread, but it's basically a quick bread. So, you know, your muffins and your pound cakes or what are called
more bread flour.
Quick bread. But yeah, but it's quick. You just kind of mix everything in a bowl and there's not a lot of kneading and you just let it sit there. But the crumb, the texture of it is much crummier.
Don't get me wrong. I had both loaves today for breakfast with my eggs and steak, and they both tasted good, but hers was just like way prettier and fuller. And
one was sourdough, one was...
Yeah, it was just a pancake.
Some variation of bread.
Anyways, I digress. Okay, anything else on that topic of starting this business of coaching, or excuse me, cooking for athletes? Anything we missed in terms of...
You know, I think that I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I was talking with someone last night who was kind of, you know, people hear this and they're like, oh, well, you could just get three clients and rent a space, and then, you know, all of a sudden, then I'm doing a meal prep service and a really high touch one, which, yes, that would be lucrative. But again, this comes back to how do you want to spend your time? You know, I have two lives. I spend part of my time cooking and being in the performance space, and I spend the other part of my time, you know, doing patient advocacy for safe safety prescription in psychiatric drug withdrawal. So I need to be able to be flexible and be able to say, okay, well, I'm going to fly to Austin and do, you know, do some podcasts and talk about the book, or and be able to have clients who understand that, okay, they're going to get their shipment, but I can take a few days and then just manage my whole schedule. And that's how I want to spend my time. That's how I want to live my life. And that is really, really important to me. And I'm doing it 100% at the expense of making lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way oftentimes when I think about the things that I'm juggling. Mm-hmm. Is like, it does feel like there's a lot on the plate at times. And it does feel like there could be an easier way to do this. But then every time I reflect, I'm like, but I like what I do.
Yeah.
So why would I stop doing it?
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's just like, I have spent my whole life working to have exactly a life like this, where I can work whenever I want. I can, you know, I don't get up with an alarm, but I don't sleep till noon either. But like, I have freedom and control over my life. Mm. And that's what people want. So don't fix what's not broken.
I have a round of rapid fire questions for you. Whatever the first thing is that comes to mind.
Okay.
What's your best business advice?
Learn as many random things as you can so you can have a conversation with anyone about anything.
Whoa. Okay. That is a great one. I've not heard that one. What's your best marketing advice?
If you hate it, don't do it.
Because you're not going to stick with it.
Yep.
What's your favorite part about entrepreneurship?
Being in charge of my own life.
When are you the most productive?
Mornings.
Who is your inspiration?
Tim Ferriss.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you met him yet?
No.
He's in town.
Yes.
He'll be at South By this year.
I will not be at South By this year.
All right. Well, tell me one secret or something most people don't know about you.
I can clap with one hand.
Prove it.
This doesn't look attractive.
Oh, God, that's amazing. Okay, what would you change about yourself?
You know, not a lot. I really like myself. I mean,
That's a huge statement.
I really like myself. Yeah, I kind of wish I had just woken up earlier.
Gotten off the antidepressants.
Yeah, and just kind of gotten my shit together earlier and realized that life was not actually a sad sack shit show that I thought it was.
That's freaking great advice. What's your favorite app or resource right now?
App or resource. Honestly, it's not very creative. Probably just YouTube, just because YouTube University can solve any problem. It was teaching me how to put my Blackstone griddle together a couple days ago.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Just
almost every time I run into a problem, I get on YouTube and try to solve it.
There's a guy I really like who I can't remember what the account name is, but he literally started his account to teach girls stuff that their dads would have taught them if they had dads. And because my dad died, there's a lot that I didn't learn that he would have taught me, like how to fix my sink or install something. And it's great. I've used his channel so many times and it warms my heart that there's some guy out there just like, this is how you change a tire, because a lot of us didn't get a chance to learn that and our dads were supposed to teach us.
That is cool. You don't know the name of it?
No.
You have to send it.
We can find it.
Yeah. Are you running away from something or towards something?
I'm definitely not running away from anything. So therefore, I suppose I'm running towards something, but kind of just open. I don't know. I don't have a bucket list.
Hmm.
So I'm just kind of like, dazzle me, universe.
I like that. It's a good approach. Well, this will be an interesting question for you. How long have you been in Austin?
36 hours.
36 hours. In your 36 hours that you've been here, what's been your favorite part?
The humidity.
The humidity?
I live in the desert. It's great. I'm just standing here and kind of soaking it up. What I didn't expect about it is how open it feels, how much green space and even just driving down the highway, you don't feel like you're in a concrete jungle. And I really appreciate that.
It's very unique to Austin. You go to any other cities around here and it's not quite like that.
Yeah.
I have one last question. Before I ask the question, though, I want to acknowledge you.
Thank you
for writing a book, for also being friends with Joel somehow, for joining me here in Austin for this interview, for helping so many other people with depression and getting off antidepressant medications, and from sharing your story, and for showing us that you can clap with one hand. Thank you.
Especially for that last part.
Before I ask my last question, what's your plug? Where can people find you?
You can find me all over the internet at Brookseem, so B-R-O-O-K-E-S-I-E-M.
Cool. Last question. It's really whatever your best piece of advice is to your younger self related to starting one of your many businesses, I guess you could say, whether it was from the bakery or maybe it was from the cooking business, whatever, whichever one you want to take, it's totally up to you. But what's maybe the best piece of advice you could give to someone else that would be in that similar circumstance or to your younger self if they were to start over from ground zero?
Yeah. I think that especially when you're young and you're not one of these people who knows what you want to do, that it's really valuable to, again, follow their creativity, but you got to trust that when you're doing all these things that don't seem to make any sense at all, that in time they will come together and make a lot of sense. And this is the perfect example is, you know, with this performance cooking and cooking with athletes. If I had looked at my life 10 years ago and said, how does it make any sense that, you know, I was a high level CrossFit athlete and that I own Boozy Bakery and I live in New York, how is this all going to come together and help me? I would have had no idea. But when you become an interesting person by learning lots of different things, then you interact with a lot of different people and you start to see the problems that you can solve by having a really unique skill set. And then you're able to insert yourself and say, hey, you know, I can do this and I can solve that problem for you. Or if someone says, can you solve this problem for me? You have the tools to do it. And that is a huge benefit of being someone who has no idea what they want to do until their late 30s. And so I would just tell anyone who's 25 and confused to just keep following what's interesting. Don't worry about if it doesn't seem to connect because it will connect at some point in a way that nobody else will be able to connect it.
Great advice. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey friend, thanks for listening to the show. And if you have any feedback for me about the show or any other guests that you'd want to see in the show, definitely shoot me a message. I love engaging with my audience and figuring out how I can provide the best value possible to the people listening to this show. Before you go, I only have one ask of you, and that would be to check out my 3 Tips Tuesday newsletter. It's 3 marketing tips every Tuesday specifically for the health and fitness entrepreneur to help them attract new leads. If you press the link in the description, it'll take you directly to the archive of all my previous newsletters, and you can decide for yourself if it's something for you. If you end up finding it helpful, you can just sign up for the newsletter and you'll get it in your inbox every Tuesday. Thanks again, and keep hustling, my friends.